Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This Friday in Madison, a summit that is titled Powering Positive Action. Business leaders, elected officials, clean energy advocates from all over the state and beyond will be meeting for the 2013 Energy Policy Summit that is organized by Renew Wisconsin. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about energy in the state of Wisconsin, and we'll have two guests with us. The former governor of the state of Colorado, Bill Ritter, will join us at the top of the show. He now serves as director of the Center for the New Energy Economy at Colorado State University, and we have read that he is on the short list to be the next energy secretary. Michael Vickerman will also join us, program and policy director for Renew Wisconsin, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And Renew, we should say, is now in its 21st year, and it has a policy framework that has supported growth in the renewable energy marketplace, and it does that on many different fronts. We'll be talking about different kinds of renewable energy this hour of the program, and welcome your calls and your emails, talk@wpr.org. Also, we have this Facebook page, so if you'd like to leave messages there, we love to read them, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we start with the former governor of the state of Colorado, who is the keynote speaker at the event on Friday. Governor Ritter, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, and thank you for hosting me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. So we read you're on the short list to be energy secretary. Do you have any news?
No, I'm pretty much not commenting about that. So don't have any news to tell you, and I doubt that I will tomorrow either.
All right. You have said, though, in responding to questions about the possible appointment, that this is a crucial time for the country to focus on energy policy, among other priorities. Energy has to be a priority going forward. Why is this a crucial time, Governor?
Well, I think that one of the reasons that I certainly am involved in this is that we as a country have a leadership role to play around the world, and can demonstrate for the world that actually in the 21st century you can build out an energy sector that is clean, that actually creates jobs, and you can protect ratepayers doing it. That many of the myths that people have about developing sort of a clean energy economy, many of those myths are wrong. And that the United States, as it's really one of the strongest nations in the world, has this role to play. Now, the states within that have their own role, but when I was referencing, I was talking about the federal government, really, because I think we lack a cohesive national energy strategy. We lack a national energy strategy that's actually tied to environmental concerns and public health concerns. We also lack a national energy strategy that really looks at the economic development possibilities around developing this 21st century agenda. So my hope is that over the next 4 years, over President Obama's term, that the Congress, the Senate, can come to a place of taking the politics out of energy, can come to a place of finding common ground between Republicans and Democrats, and understand really the need for us as a country to act on an energy agenda, and you watch, Kathleen, if we do that, you'll see countries around the world respond in kind.
There come moments in our experience, our human experience, when we realize that the time is now. Would you say, considering the reports in the news all over this week have been that 2012 was the hottest year on record, we're dealing with Hurricane Sandy with a significant drought in the Midwest, that we all of a sudden have realized, because of all of these events, that the time is now, we're more likely to take action?
Well, I do think that people who are in policy-making positions understand there's a greater urgency. I mean, there have been quite a few people saying the time is now for a while.
Yes.
Right? I mean, we, as governor, I think I signed 57 different clean energy bills because I thought from 2007, 2011 that the time is now. the real concern is that, you know, people, scientists have said, well, a warming of the planet that's 2 degrees will bring with it pretty serious consequences. There's a lot of scientists now who are saying, listen, we're going to shoot right by 2 degrees. The question is, can we stop this? Can we reverse what's happening, the warming or the, you know, the global changes? Can we reverse that before we get to 4 degrees? Because at 4 degrees, the results can be cataclysmic, and they're global in scope. And, you know, we've had some experiences this past year in 2012 that I think, you know, a variety of folks might tie back to climate change. Certainly in the West, we had a really significant drought. We've had terrible wildfires.
Yes.
You know, we have over 3 million acres of pine beetle kill in Colorado that all the forest experts I've talked to would say this is directly related to warming and to, you know, changes in precipitation that are themselves also related to warming. And so we're looking at, you know, a variety of different circumstances that point to the same thing. And then you have, you know, Hurricane Sandy, I think, that was really an exclamation point on all the other problems that we, the weather problems that we'd experienced in the United States. And so I do think that there's a sort of a different view about this, certainly by the American people, hopefully by the decision makers, by policymakers, both at the state and at the federal level.
You in the state of Colorado boosted the state's renewable energy standard from 20 to 30% by 2020. Can you talk more about that, what that means, and if that was one of the more significant pieces of legislation during your gubernatorial tenure?
Well, there's a little more history to it. There have been a lot of efforts to pass a renewable energy standard through the legislature, get it to the governor's desk prior to my being governor. They kept failing, those efforts did, and so there's a group of people that actually put it on the ballot, which you can do in Colorado. You can have a ballot measure for something like this that's a legislative item. Put it on the ballot. It was a renewable energy standard of 10% by 2015, so identical to what Wisconsin now has, and that was 2004. It was clear when I was running for governor that we were going to meet that and probably beat that. It's going to be long before 2015 when we got to 10%. So what I did in the first 100 days of being governor, I signed a bill that took our renewable energy standard to 20% by 2020. And this is a really important part of it. We put in place a 2% rate cap, meaning that if, you know, you get to 20% of your renewable energy standard, the utility couldn't charge you more than 2%, you know, that they would have charged over and above the least cost of fuel to get 20% of renewables on the grid. Interesting, while I was governor, we could see that the utility was being very aggressive and bound to meet their 20% standard by 2020. So in 2010, then, we went to 30% renewable energy by 2020, and we didn't change the rate cap. It was still at 2% because we saw the price of wind come down very dramatically. We do give the utility a premium for bringing the power from inside the state to create in-state jobs. And so, you know, XL Energy last year, our primary utility, they had a day last April when 57% of the power that they delivered to Coloradans, they delivered from wind energy.
Oh, my goodness. Yep. Isn't that significant?
So we really had an aggressive build-out. At the beginning of, you know, the millennium in 2000, we had no wind on the grid. By the time I became governor, we had a little over, I think it was 270 megawatts. We now have over 2,000 megawatts of wind on the grid, and that's a pretty short period of time, you know, to see that kind of a buildup. But that really has caused the price of wind to come down pretty dramatically. You know, the price of wind in Colorado is cheaper than coal, and we're a coal-producing state, but the price of wind is cheaper. We've seen two deals that our utility has undertaken over the last year where it was like 3.2 cents a megawatt hour, or I'm sorry, a kilowatt hour. You add in the production tax credit, that's 5.4 cents, and that's very cheap power.
What other sources of renewable energy are on the grid or could be on the grid in greater numbers than they are now?
Well, solar, for sure. Actually, when we did our 30% renewable energy standard, we had a carve-out for distributed generation solar, which means, you know, smaller solar projects. There's kind of a difference between concentrated solar power there can be big projects, you know, 300, 400 megawatts, and then rooftop solar or, you know, other kinds of community arrays. So we had a carve-out and said 3% of that 30% has to be distributed generation solar, just to try and help build out that market. And we've seen the build-out of that in a pretty significant way as well.
What's keeping us, Governor Ritter? You mentioned the fact that jobs were created, that you had cleaner energy in the state of Colorado. Why isn't yours a model for all of the states in the country right now?
Well, quite frankly, there's a big battle. You know, there are the incumbents, the people who now are part of our electricity sector. You know, there's a lot of coal generation in this country, and I think there's been real concern that coal generation is going to lose market share. It, in fact, has lost market share, but most of the market share it lost to natural gas. So there's opposition inside state houses when you try and move a renewable energy standard or an energy efficiency resource standard. We should talk about energy efficiency because it really is the other big way for us to reduce our emissions, is for us to just reduce our power use. There's a variety of really important things to do that you can do, but inside state houses, there are people who represent the coal industry and they oppose renewable energy standards. There's also some number of folks, and you know, we're trying to make it not about political parties, about Republicans versus Democrats, but you know, in the 2010 elections, when sort of the Tea Party folks were elected, there were a lot of them that said we're just opposed to any mandate, and they look at a renewable energy standard and say, well, that's a mandate. And my response to those folks is that most things in the energy sector is, in fact, regulated. Even in states where they say they're a deregulated state, energy is still highly regulated through legislative efforts or other kinds of rulemaking. There's no state where it's unregulated. You know, you may not have the Public Utility Commission in charge of the investor-owned utilities or regulated in, but in fact, there's still a lot of statutes and a lot of rules in place. And we have chosen to do that with the energy sector since its inception, since the early 1900s. We've chosen to regulate that sector. And so the renewable energy standard, the energy efficiency resource standard, their mandates, and there's a crowd of folks saying we wanted to operate like the free market. And they're supported by, you know, a lot of what I would call the coal lobby. The other thing that's happened is natural gas is really come to the table and been able to make a case that there's this serious supply of tight shale gas, and the price of gas has been very low and fairly stable for now 3 or 4 years. And with that, we've seen a transition out of coal to natural gas, and there are renewable energy technologists that think that they can go toe-to-toe with, you know, cheap natural gas, but just not yet. So I think that those are the two things, the lobby, that's the coal lobby that opposes a kind of move toward a clean energy agenda is one. And then secondly, cheap natural gas is kind of the second thing. And in Colorado, we are actually using natural gas in conjunction, integrating it with renewables to get to our 30% standard. You know, we passed that by the legislature, but we also shut down a gigawatt of coal and transitioned it to natural gas.
Governor Ritter is our guest this hour. Michael Vickerman will be our guest the second half hour, Program and Policy Director for Renew Wisconsin. The governor mentioned energy efficiency and what we're doing in terms of appliances that don't use as much energy, et cetera. We'll get to that, but we have a ton of phone calls, and I want to make sure that you enter this conversation momentarily. There is a major energy conference, the 2013 Energy Policy Summit, that is organized by Renew Wisconsin. It's going to be in Madison this coming Friday, and the keynote speaker is our guest this first half hour. Bill Ritter is former governor of Colorado from 2007 to 2011, and now serves as director of the Center for the New Energy Economy at Colorado State University. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@WPR.org. And the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I guess the first half hour is the former governor of the state of Colorado. He currently serves as director of the Center for the New Energy Economy at Colorado State University. Mr. Bill Ritter is our guest, and we go to Mark for our first call in Richland Center. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. You talked about energy efficiency, and the city of New York uses more energy to heat and cool buildings than it uses for transportation. So our built infrastructure is really very inefficient. We use this thing called insulation, but if we built buildings that had a second wall to the outside of the existing structure, we could build with what's called outsolation, and then the interior structure of the building would become a thermal mass that doesn't move hot in the direction of hot or cold very fast, because thermal inertia slows the heating and cooling. But once a building is warmed up, if you can slow the rate of cooling, then it becomes a much more efficient building. In the state of Wisconsin, our geology is dolomite limestone, and old world cement actually doesn't even pass heat and cold. It's thermally non-conductive. So if we were to start businesses in the state of Wisconsin using dolomite limestone, reacting that with phosphorus, which we could even just get from cow manure the way they used to make bricks in the old world, we could build with outsolation around the existing infrastructure of lots and lots of buildings in this country and change the energy efficiency of the buildings while creating millions of jobs. And we could build brick plants at locations all over the place, because bricks are heavy and you don't want to ship them long distances. So we would be creating a huge infrastructure of jobs while at the same time not having to abandon our existing buildings, but simply make them more efficient.
Governor Ritter.
He's right, and so I agree with your caller. It's not just New York City, right? Built infrastructure in America is still fairly energy inefficient. So there are two things about that. One is, going forward, you know, again, this is where states, municipalities have a really significant role in trying to ensure that as we build out new buildings, that we're doing them, you know, along the lines of how your caller described it, which would be, you know, looking at the most energy efficient ways, and that'll vary with the climate and vary with sort of, as you said, the geology of the place. There's different building materials, but that is a fact. So that's new buildings. For old buildings, you know, when we go back and retrofit, there's a variety of ways where either, you know, in the industrial sector or the residential sector, there are contractors who are, you know, able to say, come into an industry and say, we can save you money. We'll save you actually more money than, you know, your electricity bill, or we'll save you this much money. And they're called performance contracts. You can do it with government buildings, but you can also do it with in private industry. And we're seeing a lot of industries, a lot of businesses inside of industry who are saying, this is a no-brainer to be able to reduce our electrical usage because we retrofitted the buildings that we're currently operating in. And so it really is part of our message with respect to a new energy economy or an advanced energy economy, is that we need to look at the built environment and ask all of the ways that we can go and retrofit it so that it uses less energy.
What other ways, as Governor Ritter, did you propose and get passed to get all of the people in Colorado to use less energy in terms of the products they use, the refrigerators, et cetera?
Well, I can't say that all the people use less energy. I mean, I think that we had a fairly significant agenda for clean energy, and I think that the people of Colorado were pretty supportive of that. We did a few things with our utility. We gave them an incentive, the utility, to actually incentivize their customers to use less energy. And so it's called demand-side management. Now, the investor-owned utility is really only about 60-65% of the power. The rural electric associations are about 35%, 40% of the power in Colorado. And so, actually, you know, they're not regulated. And so we didn't have the same ability to incentivize them through demand-side management. We also, when we had the stimulus funding, there was funding there for energy efficiency. Instead of paying contractors to go in and you know, put in place, you know, insulation or energy efficient building materials, what we did was contract with an engineer and an auditor that would go in and do an energy audit, and the engineer would help, you know, this is primarily government entities, help those government entities to figure out, could they do something that in the lines of a performance contract that was going to cause them to use less energy, then they would contract with the performance contractor. So it wasn't the stimulus dollars that were part of that. It was just our providing them with an engineer, with a list of preferred contractors with others. What we found was there was a real leverage on those dollars, those state dollars, where we put a little bit of money in and had a lot of economic activity as a result of that through this performance contracting.
Let's go to, thanks, Mark, very much for your informative call. Jack in Eagle River, hi.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. My wife and I lived in California, Northern California, through the 70s and 80s. And in the late 70s, we had solar panels for our hot water heating put on our home. And along about 1980, along came the Gipper, and I don't think that energy savings was high on his priority list. But the point is that we almost paid for our solar installation through tax relief, through tax incentives. And secondly, PG&E, the electric company, gave us a large cash rebate when we stopped using our electric water heater. And the whole thing just sort of collapsed along about the very early 80s. And it was a shame because it seemed like the companies that were active in the solar industry just kind of wilted, and that was the end of it. So I think the incentives should be a big part of what we're trying to do.
So this is an interesting part of the conversation because a lot of people actually criticize the solar industry for not being able to survive without some kinds of subsidy. But Jimmy Carter, who I really got to know Jimmy Carter while I was governor. I went on a trip with him up in the Arctic. There was a group of us that went and just sort of looked at the Arctic and had a swimming salon, and we had Republicans and Democrats on the boat. We had a lot of business people who were part of this trip as well, and it was really a fascinating opportunity. But I got to know Jimmy Carter, and he really, for all the ways that people might criticize him as a president, he really had a vision for what we should do as a country to become energy independent. And it was more about that than it was about climate change at the time. But he had or made a real push around solar energy particularly, but some wind energy as well. And like Jack said, you know, when President Reagan was elected, he had a whole different view about how we should move the country forward and with respect to energy. And I think, you know, no other president is probably been as a visionary about energy and energy independence as Jimmy Carter was. And now we're at a place where it's more urgent. It's not just about energy independence for us as a country. It's about, you know, climate change issues. It's certainly about the global economic competition. All those things are in play. And we need to be sort of back to where Jimmy Carter wanted us to be in 1979 and 1980. There are a variety of incentives that are in place to help sort of with the build out of solar. People criticize that, but quite frankly, there are tax credits all across the energy spectrum for any kind of fuel. Almost every fuel that we look at, there's some kind of a subsidy in place that's helping sort of the operators, you know, produce that form of energy. The fact of the matter is, with photovoltaic panels, though, the price has come down dramatically. So they're getting very close to what's called grid parity, meaning, you know, you can take the subsidy away and they'll be able to survive. If they're competing with coal, with natural gas, with home heating oil, there's a variety of different, you know, sources. There are fossil fuel sources, and the folks who are making photovoltaic panels are just trying to do everything they can to bring down the price of the panels, but also what we call the system cost. And in doing so, I think you're going to see this really broader deployment. One of the things I'm going to urge tomorrow, or when I speak to the conference in Wisconsin, is that they look at things like third-party solar, where someone else owns the solar, leases it to the homeowner. The homeowner has the solar installation on top of their house. Somebody else owns it, and you're producing power on this leased system, but you don't have to pay the upfront cost. What we've seen in Colorado is it's taken off in a really significant way, so that 80% of all the new solar installations in Colorado, Arizona, and California last year were leased systems. Mm. The legislation you have to pass to do that. But there's a variety of things that we can do to push this, and as Jack said, you know, there may be some incentives to help push it along, particularly if we think this is this important social good, but it is an industry that is burgeoning in a very significant way and can get to grid parity, we think, probably sometime in this decade.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Governor Ritter, for being with us, and we'll look forward to your appearance tomorrow in Madison for the second annual Energy Policy Summit sponsored by Renew Wisconsin. Positive Action is the name of the summit, and Governor Ritter, the former governor of Colorado from 2007 to 2011, who now serves as director of the Center for the New Energy Economy at Colorado State University, will be the keynote speaker. We continue our conversation and we just change guests. Michael Vickerman is program and policy director of Renew Wisconsin, which has been around in the state of Wisconsin for a number of years. They have certain goals now as we enter 2013 and beyond. Positive Action, the name of tomorrow's summit, and it will gather business leaders, elected officials, clean energy advocates to look at a policy agenda and an achievable policy agenda. We will be talking about that and welcoming phone calls. Jack, thanks for yours. Our lines are still open and our email and all of that. It's 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be on the show, Kathleen.
Tell me, in 2013, tell me about the progress that we've made. Let's go back to Jimmy Carter's time, because he was kind of front and center the last 5 minutes. In 1979, how much progress have we made in Wisconsin in terms of getting jobs in the renewable energy field and in the area of just creating renewable energy and using renewable energy?
Well, the point at which the renewable energy market in Wisconsin started to take off was about midway through the last decade, the double aughts. And it was a combination of federal policy and state policy, what we call Act 141, that was signed into law in March 2006 here. And that law did two things. It dramatically increased the renewable energy requirements on utilities. They have to source a certain amount of the energy they sell from renewable sources, and it's 10%. And almost all the utilities are pretty much through their requirements, and they're going to meet their 2015 deadline several years ahead of schedule. The second piece of that legislation was the protection of Focus on Energy. That's the statewide energy efficiency and renewable energy program, which provides incentives for customer-sited renewable technologies, solar, wind, biogas, wood, small hydro. And with that, you started to see a greater diffusion or dispersal of these smaller systems around the state, and as well a couple of large wind projects in the state and also elsewhere. And in response to that, we saw a number of companies open up renewable energy divisions and departments. In terms of wind farm construction, there's Michaels Construction and Bolt Construction, prominent construction firms. We had a company establish a panel manufacturing place in Milwaukee, Helios USA. They started operation last year. The leading biodigester design and installation firm, it's called DVO. It started out as a farm implement company in Chilton, and now is building digesters in many states and several and has international work as well. So that all emerged from the steps we took in 2006. However, in recent years, in the last 2 years, the market has slowed considerably and was in a kind of disarray in 2011, 2012. And what led to the initial policy summit last year was that the need to regroup and come up with new arguments for promoting local clean sources of renewable energy, and as well to adjust our expectations of what we can do in the current political climate, but still make progress doing so. And that the first summit was successful in being able to regroup and renew ourselves with a sense of purpose, and we're going to take it to the next level tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. I was amazed when the governor, Governor Ritter, talked about the amount of energy that's coming from wind in the state of Colorado. It's huge, isn't it?
Well, it's even more impressive, I would say, is the amount of wind energy in the state of Iowa. Iowa wind projects account for almost a quarter of all the electricity produced in that state. Some of those wind projects are actually serving Wisconsin utilities. Iowa has become the epicenter of wind development, wind manufacturing in the United States, and their economy actually was jolted by the expectation of the production tax credit for wind expiring. It was extended for a year, and so that should restore some of the work there. But Iowa's efforts in promoting and integrating wind within its resource mix is nothing short of outstanding.
Mm-hmm. And in the state of Wisconsin, which renewable can we look to, even though things are kind of breaking down now, over the past 10 years has really made terrific progress?
Well, 10 years ago, actually, the oldest wind project in Wisconsin came online in 1998, and a couple wind projects came online in 1999. They've been operating for 13 years. And investments in that area has grown a lot. So of the renewable energy sources that have been tapped to satisfy the state's renewable electricity standard, wind is the biggest contributor right now. And biomass is contributing a portion, and so is biogas from on-farm systems and industrial facilities. The resource that really has the greatest potential in Wisconsin is solar. Solar hot water and solar electricity. It's a resource that's pretty well distributed throughout the state. Any electricity customer that has decent exposure to the sun can put up a system, and hopefully in sometime in the future, near future, contract with somebody to sell energy to that customer from mm-hmm. a system that's on that person's premises. So in Minnesota, the clean energy advocacy community is about ready to launch a drive or campaign to source 10% of all the state's electricity from solar alone. That's the big prize with that they're aiming for. There's no reason why in Wisconsin we can't try to do the same, although 10% is actually the same level as what the state's renewable energy standard is, so we would have to expand the state's renewable electricity standard in order to accommodate some carve-out in solar. But long-term, and actually not so long-term, solar is really the resource with the greatest applicability to Wisconsin.
We're welcoming phone calls. Now would be a good time for you to call if you want to join the conversation. Michael Vickerman is our guest this half hour. He's Program and Policy Director for Renew Wisconsin, which is now in its 21st year, and they're having a major conference in Madison tomorrow. It's a summit that is called Powering Positive Action, and it will essentially gather the ideas of business leaders, elected officials, clean energy advocates into a policy agenda that is achievable considering a political climate in the state of Wisconsin in 2013. This organization has been around for a number of years, leading and representing all the aforementioned groups and organizations who seek more clean, renewable energy in the state of Wisconsin. 800-486-8655 is our number. Mike in Three Lakes is our first caller for you, Michael. Hello, Mike.
Good morning. I have listened to dozens of these programs, and I have never heard a single person pushing renewable energy that has come up with any idea of what the heck to do with our existing supply of coal. We have a 500-year supply of coal in this country, and no one ever thinks about what to do with it. If you don't tell the people that are heavily invested in coal some other use for the coal, you are not going to get very far. And the world's largest coal loading transshipment facility is in Superior, Wisconsin. Well, the utilities, they whine and cry, we can't make our shareholders pay for this fume scrubbing equipment to clean up coal. There's no such thing as clean coal. I can tell you, I have loaded hundreds of millions of tons of coal in my career sailing on the Great Lakes. There is nothing clean about coal. But when South Africa was pushing apartheid and couldn't buy oil, a hydrocarbon is a hydrocarbon. They made gasoline out of coal. Every single vehicle on the road these days has a catalytic converter, and the exhaust from gasolines is a whole lot cleaner than the exhaust from coal-burning power plants. If we put a 10-cent a ton tax on coal, we could build plants that would turn coal into gasoline. We would be totally independent of the Middle East for oil. We could make our own gasoline out of coal here and burn it in cars, and it would be a whole lot cleaner. And that would give the people that are heavily invested in coal something to do with their investment.
Michael.
To respond to, first of all, yes. The caller said that we have a 500-year supply of coal. I would say only a small portion of that period of time will the coal actually be economically competitive with other resources. It's becoming increasingly expensive to pull coal out of the ground. The most accessible reserves are being tapped, and in case of Appalachia, have been tapped. And so the quality of the coal is declining. The amount, the expenditures needed to extract the coal out of the ground is increasing. And so the price of coal over the last 5 years has gone up considerably. That's been one of the principal drivers of rising electric rates, is the rising cost of coal. Now, the caller makes a valid point that the utilities are heavily invested in their coal-burning infrastructure, and they want to use and generate profits from those facilities as long as possible. However, they are running into certain realities regarding the expense of retrofitting older coal units. So Wisconsin Public Service, the Green Bay utility, just entered into a consent decree a couple days ago. They will shut down their older units in Green Bay. Alliant, which operates the Nelson Dewey plant in Cassville, they're shutting down that plant in 2 years. And they're doing this really for economic reasons, because the cost of coal is rising, the cost of conforming to regulatory requirements is rising, and right now natural gas is very cheap. So what the utilities have decided to do is to buy large gas generation units, and they're banking their future on that. We'll see how that plays out. But in the meantime, there is still a lot of room for renewable energy in there as the utilities slowly wake up to the fact that coal star is dimming rather rapidly, and renewables really should be part of the mix so that they can use their natural gas generating plants judiciously.
Thank you, Mike, very much for your call. More phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Hour two of our program today, David Skinner on his new book, The Story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. Just a preview, it was the Webster Dictionary published in 1961, but the book looks at our thoughts about language, using proper language, where that comes from, using everyday language in speech, dictionaries including that or not including that. It's a been a raging debate in America for a long time. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we return to phone calls for Michael Vickerman, Program and Policy Director, Renew Wisconsin, 800-486-8655. I should ask you, Michael, about the conference, because I think we may have a few listeners who want to pop in perhaps for part of it. Is that possible?
I think there's still some room left. The name of the policy summit is Powering Positive Action. It'll be held at the Pyle Center at UW-Madison on Langdon Street, and there's space for additional registration.
Okay, let's go to Don in Janesville. Hi, Don.
Hello. How are you doing this morning?
All right, Don. Thank you.
Hey, two comments. One on solar, which is it's not feasible. I mean, Denmark was a leader for how many years, and they outlawed it because of the environmental and the health issues. And something nobody talks about is the mandatory thermal backfill that you have to use when you install those systems, the mandatory upgrades to the grid when you have to run them in. You're looking at destroying fields and pulling up the drain tile when you put them in, and you've got to run those cranes back in there when you deal with them. And now I'd like to look also at the hazardous oil that sits in the top of those nacelles when those things run and their limited lifespan. A GE 1.5, what they advertise and what they get out of it are two different things. And the other comment I'll make real quick on coal, Prairie State Generating System, which is a division of Peabody Coal down in Lively Grove, Illinois, is 99.9% emissions-free and about the greenest coal plant you'll ever see. It's coming out of the ground, running on a half-mile conveyor, going straight into the pulverizers and into the system. They've got the AQCS system on it. They've got the absorbers, and it's completely clean, and it's cold, and we're using a resource, and we're not trucking it anywhere.
Michael.
To the caller's first point about wind power in Denmark, Denmark has not outlawed wind generation. When Denmark is adding to its fleet of wind generators, mostly offshore, and they're replacing their older turbines with newer turbines. Wind is a very reliable source of clean energy, as is being demonstrated in Iowa and Texas, where there are significant amounts of wind power on their system. The grid operators can handle it, and they don't represent any kind of environmental threat, even when they're decommissioned. In fact, two turbines were decommissioned near Green Bay late last year, and now that area is being farmed. So in regards to coal, yes, you can remove some of the mercury. Yes, you can remove some of the sulfur dioxide and other impurities from the combustion process, but there's nothing you really can do with the carbon dioxide. And in fact, purifying the coal or the removing those impurities actually results in a lowering of the thermal efficiency in burning coal. The thing about coal is that it comes from deep in the ground elsewhere in the country. We can use the resources we have within the state to provide a significant part of our electric energy and our thermal energy. And when we source that energy close to home, we avoid transmission investments, and we employ people to manufacture those systems, to install those systems, and to maintain those systems. There is a much higher job multiplier effect with local renewables than there is with coal that comes from Wyoming.
He mentioned health issues associated with solar. I must say I've never heard of that. Have you?
There aren't any.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call, Don. Let's go to Jane from Menominee, who sends an email. How environmentally friendly is fracking, and if there is room for improvement, would this not create new jobs so we can get this energy and create jobs?
Well, fracking is generating a tremendously large body of information regarding its environmental impacts, and a lot of it still isn't known. In the case of Wisconsin, I don't believe that there are any reserves of shale gas that can be extracted through the hydraulic fracturing process. This is done in other states. Fracking has resulted in an increase in the amount of natural gas that's available. And pardon me a second.
Okay.
And so, that has caused a reduction in the natural gas prices, which is the benefit of that to people in Wisconsin is that our heating bills have gone down dramatically in the last 5 years. It's not just simply warmer winters. Certainly, we've seen those and are going through one right now. But also, it's because of the increase in natural gas. It makes it more difficult for competitive for other resources to compete with natural gas. That's just a struggle right now for wind and solar and other resources, which we have to get through.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen Matt Damon's film?
I have not.
Yeah, I think you'll like it. I think it's a. I'd be interested. I wish I had seen it so I could get your response to it. But I don't think it'll be a big moneymaker, but it's an interesting film addressing this issue.
But it does tell you a little bit about the lengths we have to go to find new reserves of fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
This is not low-hanging fruit anymore. This involves fracturing bedrock to get at this resource. And while it's a technological marvel, its environmental impacts and its expense are unknowns. There is a body of information out there that suggests that the cost of fracking is much higher than what we're seeing right now. That the only reason why fracking has resulted in this large outflow of natural gas is because the same companies are making profits through the sale of other resources, including oil and liquids like propane, and that's sort of subsidizing the cost of natural gas. And so that we'll see how that plays out in the markets a year from now, because there's a pretty strong disincentive right now to going into new shale plays. Because of the low price of natural gas, they can't make a profit right now.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to quickly get to a couple more calls. Bob in the UP. Hi, Bob. Bob, are you there? Bob's not there. Chris in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
I guess my question is, obviously, you know, Wisconsin's an agricultural state. And, you know, we saw a drought last year, a state of emergency declared by the governor. I guess my question is, why is it so hard to, you know, get people onto the idea that alternative energy is important, and what are we not doing that we should be to communicate that message?
All right, good question.
Yes, that is a good question. Well, I think part of the problem is that we don't do a good enough job of publicizing the success stories and casting a spotlight on those people, on those companies that have decided to take matters into their own hand and invest in technologies that make them more energy self-sufficient and cleaner. And that's part of what we're going to correct in our meeting tomorrow, Powering Positive Action. We'll have an awards ceremony. And that awards ceremony will highlight the customer generators that put wind systems, biodigesters, and solar on their facilities. So in Madison or Dane County, one company, Epic, has the largest solar system in the state, and that was installed last year and is just finalizing a six wind turbine project along Highway 12. Now, and that's to supply or offset emissions from its own use. This is where the action is right now in Wisconsin and in a few other states. It's with companies that have a long-term and very strongly defined sense of sustainability and are making the investments necessary to make themselves more competitive in the future.
Michael, we're out of time. I thank you very much for being with us. Michael Vickerman, our guest this half hour, Program and Policy Director for Renew Wisconsin. The Energy Summit takes place tomorrow in Madison. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program. Thanks for all of your interest.